You speak of a code of honor. But what you are saying now, according to our customs, is called an act of war.
This is not an act of war, but of love. I want Lieutenant Yard to become my first wife.
I challenge your right of supersedence.
No woman has challenged supersedence for over 200 years.
The right is mine and I will have it. Natasha Yar, I challenge you. A struggle to the death.
No. The challenge is unequivocally refused.
Then you shall have no treaty, no vaccine, and no Lieutenant Yar.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
Well, this is Tyler Orton reporting for duty.
And now, for this week's conundrum, early TNG, what went wrong?
Nothing went wrong, Cam. It's my favorite two seasons of all Star Trek. Why are we even doing this?
So on that note, this assignment is complete.
Wow. No, you know, I guess the inspiration for this, a few months ago, you and I both watched Chaos on the Bridge. This is a William Shatner documentary.
Did he really make this documentary? Because it says written and directed by William Shatner.
The thing is, he gets ghostwriters for his books.
Tech War.
Yeah, and the other thing is, like, he did The Captains, or so he says. I'm very skeptical of all these credentials that he applies to these films.
Yeah, he also made that Get a Life one.
Yeah. I don't think he's writing and directing them. He's definitely...
taking the credit?
Well, I'd say he's more of kind of an exec producer role.
Right.
I just wonder, like, I think it's more like people pitching him ideas, and he's like, okay, I'll do that. Because do you really think he was that interested... and what was going on in the first two seasons of Star Trek The Next Generation?
Well, he said he was.
He said he was. You know, he also...
Do you think he's watched the first two seasons of TNG?
No.
I don't think so either.
No, I don't think he watched one episode.
You don't think not one?
No. In its entirety? I'm sure he saw some clips. I don't think he watched one full episode, though.
The other thing is, like, Shatner is a really busy guy. He's booked solid.
Yeah.
So you're telling me he's finding time to prep and, like, write and direct these documentaries on the side?
Like,
he's racing horses.
Oh, yeah. But the thing is, viewers, you don't have to watch the documentary for you to enjoy this particular podcast. But, I mean, there will be spoilers for the documentary. But really,
which is really just spoilers for real life.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, but, I mean, he's essentially sitting down with a lot of old executives from Paramount, writers, actors, just getting behind-the-scenes look at, like, why was... this such a tumultuous two seasons for Star Trek The Next Generation.
It was?
Well, I Cam, give me a two-word answer to the question I just asked you.
What question?
What was the reason behind all this chaos on the bridge during those first two seasons? And you can only give me a two-word response.
Is it a name?
Yes.
Gene Roddenberry?
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, and that's what you and I have touched upon a lot throughout the podcast, Cam, on other episodes, that Gene Roddenberry, as much as I respect the guy, he was very much a vision guy.
Yeah.
He was not an execution man. And when you give him the keys to the car and he's in charge of execution, you end up with Star Trek Next Generation seasons 1 and 2.
I mean, I will go to bat for him quite hard for the original series.
Yeah.
He was, I think, really invaluable in a lot of that show's success. Obviously, he surrounded himself with great people.
Yeah.
But he was known to rewrite all the scripts himself. Like, he brought a lot to the table. But it was also a different era of television. And we have seen, after Gene Roddenberry, he was kind of one of the earliest cases of taking an original sort of sci-fi creator, even fantasy, whatever... genre creator, and bringing them back decades later to try and revive their older, you know, an older property and, you know, relive their success, and it not working.
Yeah.
We've seen this since then many times. We've seen it with Spielberg and the Indiana Jones movies. We've seen it with Peter Jackson and the Hobbit movies. We've seen it famously with George Lucas and the prequels. Ridley Scott and Prometheus. That one's maybe a little more controversial to say, but really, other than George Miller and the Mad Max franchise... it's been a pretty much a washout.
Do you think people just kind of lose their touch when it comes to connecting with the material like they originally did?
Well, I think that's part of it. And I think a lot of their early success kind of came out of like almost desperation. Like they made it at a time where they were fighting against a system in a project they believed in. Everything was going against them and they were like, we're going to pull this off. Whereas when they came back, it was like, guys, this will be a sure thing. You know, make it happen. Here's all the resources you need to make it happen. And I think that doesn't work. There was an interesting article, actually, an interview with Spielberg, because he's up out hyping the BFG right now. This just came out, like, I think today. It was, I think, the Washington Post. And he was talking about how he said all of his sequels have never lived up to the originals because he was way too confident going to the sequels because he knew they'd be successful.
Right.
And he was saying, you know, The Lost World is not even close to Jurassic Park. And he was very upfront about that.
But, yeah, but how many other sequels did he do?
Well, he did the Indiana Jones sequels.
Okay, of course, yeah.
So, yeah.
But, well, okay. You bring up a good point, bringing, you know, creators back to their material after like a 20-year absence. Mm-hmm. This is what Chaos on the Bridge is focusing on a lot, is what happened in those intervening years with Gene Roddenberry.
Yeah.
Essentially, he's doing one of two things. Or, well, no, he's up to a couple things. He's going to conventions,
right,
where people are idolizing him and telling him what a great man he is.
And what a genius.
Mm-hmm. You're a visionary, sir.
Right.
And other than that, he's not really working very much.
Which, as an artist, would absolutely demoralize you and I think give you a real kind of complex.
Yeah.
Yeah.
After the motion picture comes out in 1979, he's tossed aside. And he wrote the script. Or, well, no, he didn't. But, like, he very much influenced that script there. It was his baby.
He wrote an initial draft, and then it was rewritten. And yeah.
Yeah. After that, he's given a bungalow on the Paramount lot, and he just sits there for, like, 6 years.
Yeah.
Like, just answering mail from fans. And what they're getting at here, and one Richard Arnold, his former assistant, will 100% disagree. I've heard him disagree with this assessment at conventions. But what other people were saying is that he starts to believe his own hype, that he is this visionary, that he needs to show the world what his utopia would look like.
Right.
And that's what we get with those first two seasons of Star Trek The Next Generation. Mm-hmm. Cam, what do you think are some of the deficits that we see maybe those early two seasons there?
I think there's a serious confusion over the era of television it's being produced in. Because obviously it's 1987. It should feel kind of current to 87. But it feels like Gene Roddenberry really reaching into the past, trying to kind of drag 1960s Star Trek kicking and screaming into the 80s.
Well, just even musical cues. I was watching Code of Honor.
Right.
Oh, dear.
I was watching The Neutral Zone.
Yeah.
And there are, I don't know if you remember, but they find three, like, 1980s people in space who have been cryogenically frozen, bring them back. There are wacky comedy music cues of, like, twanging guitars and stuff like that. As, like, they say things to the Enterprise crew and they, like, look at each other. It's like, twang, twang, twang on the soundtrack. It's like, oh, my God.
It just doesn't work. And, you know, you wonder how much he's having an influence. Because here's the thing. You go through 1960s, 70s, 80s, 90s, there's this progression in how storytelling goes in television.
Yeah.
And with that, you wonder how much of his experience from the 60s is just having a complete and utter influence on what we're getting right now. They hired Maurice Hurley to be the showrunner of that series. Maurice Hurley, you can tell that guy's got a huge ego.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Yeah. But he's bringing up the fact, like, he worked on shows like Miami Vice, which at the time were probably the most groundbreaking series on television.
And The Equalizer, also very popular.
Yeah, and so he has a grasp on how television of the 80s could
operates,
be. You know, what it should be, you know.
Right.
He's dealing with Gene Roddenberry on a day-to-day basis, who's going with, he's being torn in a couple different directions. He's going with these very much 1960s sort of storytelling motifs. And then he also wants to do this new vision of what Star Trek Utopia is.
Right.
And I think that's where he falls into this big trap where, is this vision of the future anything anybody would want to watch?
Yeah, I mean, it's especially the first two seasons feel very, like, stagey and awkward and stilted. Like, it's not, I think the 1960s Star Trek, that's a future that seems exciting and fun. And Gene Roddenberry, I feel like, he didn't understand what people loved about that series. Because when you get to The Next Generation, he removes all the conflict between the characters.
Yes.
Which is what fueled the original series and made it what it was. It's more about the idea of just like man being perfect in the future, which...
And we should strive for that.
Yes.
And you still get that... You still see on social media that a lot of fans keep saying we should strive for something better.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, yeah, of course. That's one of the things that I like about it. But this whole idea that, like, there's zero conflict between, you know, crew members and Starfleet, I'm just like, oh, dear. Like, that's one of the most boring things I could ever imagine.
And isn't the journey more compelling than the destination?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
isn't it more about watching people strive to be better as opposed to people just being better?
I'm perfect. Yeah. Watch me.
Yeah.
It's like, okay. And then the kind of conflict that you do get, and I'll use where Silence has Elise as an example, internal conflict is where Worf and Riker are on an away mission, and Worf is really adamant about opening a door, and Riker has to pull him away, and they stare at each other.
Yeah.
I'm just like, is this as fascinating as Kirk and Spock and Bones like fighting over philosophy? Like,
it's interesting to me, too, that TNG was such an ensemble show under Roddenberry's guidance, because the original series wasn't. It was like he picked his three characters, he created the central drama between three of them, and then you had Scotty, who had a fairly prominent role, and then the rest were kind of background characters who got to kind of come in and interject here and there, usually check off more than the others. But when you get to TNG, suddenly Roddenberry decides we need a full ensemble of characters, and they've all got to be doing things.
Yeah.
And he loses a central relationship to really hinge it all on.
Well, the other thing is, like, yes, they all have to be doing things, but he doesn't even have a strong grasp on what they should be doing.
I don't understand what you're talking about. I thought Geordi had plenty of things to do in that first season.
That's just it. Like, they didn't know what to do with Geordi. Data's job, he inherited, like, the science and communications. They melded it into one.
Yeah.
I don't think they really knew what to do with Deanna Troi.
Worf.
He was just, like, standing... He's a glorified background player for most of that season. And then even, like, Denise Crosby, she's featured in the documentary.
Yeah.
She talks about how, at a certain point, they just wanted to get a fake pair of legs to stick behind Patrick Stewart's chair.
Yeah.
And that could just be her. Because all she did was stand there and just say, I, matey, or no, I, captain, I should say. she didn't become a pirate.
Well, she was no Katharine Hepburn, according to John Pike, former president of Paramount.
I took note of that comment. I was just like, ooh, okay.
That's kind of ugly.
What did you think of this Paramount executive character?
I liked him.
He was a compelling person to watch on screen. I would not want to do business with this fellow.
I think the reason I liked him was because he seemed a lot more reasonable than the depiction of Gene Roddenberry that we were given.
Yes.
As well as, obviously, his crazy lawyer who was running around.
Leonard Maltsev?
Something like that, yeah. And then also Maurice Hurley, the writer. Like, I'm like, I wouldn't want to work for that guy.
No.
Whereas, like, the John Pike seemed like he kind of had a sense of humor.
Yeah.
And he was kind of like understood what he wanted to do. Like, I love when he's talking about Encounter Farpoint. He's just like, I didn't know what I was watching.
Is that, if you asked me what the jellyfish were about, I couldn't tell you.
Yeah.
You know, but I just looked it up. Leonard Mazelish was the very creepy lawyer that everyone complained about in this documentary.
Yeah.
Everyone. Yeah. Essentially, he was the bad cop to Gene Roddenberry's good cop.
Right.
And I don't know how good of a cop Gene Roddenberry was throughout this, because
how many times is he referred to as blustery in this documentary?
This is the other thing that they do touch upon in the documentary, though. Like, throughout this period, he's dealing with a lot of, like, deteriorating health.
Yeah.
You know, he had a series of strokes.
And just personal demons, too. So they talk about sending him to rehab.
Yeah. He's wrestling with addiction. And also, he dies, like, midway through the run of TNG. I don't really think he was there on day-to-day operations by the time we get around to season three. He did have some influence. You know, like, he would take a look at the scripts and give Michael Piller notes.
Yeah.
You know, but, like, he wasn't at his best when he was, you know, creating this series.
He was also in a situation where he basically, by all intents and purposes, been kind of run out of Hollywood. And so now he's been given this show. He has everything staked on this show. This is his legacy project.
Yeah.
And, you know, Shatner talks in the documentary about how, like, this was his depiction of heaven. Okay. Which I don't know if I quite go for that, although Brandon Braga seemed quite compelled by that idea.
Yeah, Brandon Braga said, hey, look, you know what, I liked all these rules that were being given. It made me be more creative as a writer, because essentially, we're talking about this earlier, but like the no conflict between main characters, those mm-hmm. kinds of rules. Whereas Ron Moore, he's very upfront about it. He's like, no, this is a horrible way to write a compelling drama series. So right. I do like that kind of back and forth that like yeah. different...
Does Brandon Braga seem more like a company man to you?
Well, why do you think he was so close to Rick Berman?
Yeah, yeah.
Rick Berman is very much a company man. And John Pike even brought that up. He's like, yeah. hey, Rick, I need $2 million from your budget by the end of the year.
Yeah.
Rick, sure enough, would always deliver.
Yeah.
And so I think it makes sense that Rick Berman would implement these mandates from Gene Roddenberry, stick to the, you know, the plan, you mm-hmm. know, as the company man, and make sure that the writers weren't allowed to introduce things like internal conflict.
Right.
One of those, like, you know, very, very scandalous things to include in drama.
Right.
But I don't, Maurice Hurley, very compelling in this, and, like, he's bringing up, here's the way that he describes Gene Roddenberry's vision of their future.
Right.
Wacky doodle. I think that was actually, like, wasn't this, like, a working title for... I think Shatner told us this is a working title for the documentary. For the
documentary, yeah.
Yeah, but, I mean, like, Maurice Hurley was explaining that, you know, characters need to be accessible, they have to overcome flaws, and they have to have conflict with each other. He's button heads with Gene Roddenberry nonstop over this. And so what we're getting at is, what is going wrong with those first two seasons? There's a high turnover rate behind the scenes. I think they said yeah. that 30 staff members left just in season one alone.
Do you know what I think one of the biggest mistakes was right out of the gate? Was bringing back so many of the writers of the original series.
Well, yeah, yeah.
They, like, I think having, you know, look, I have nothing but good things to say about DC Fontana. David Gerald wrote one of the yep. greatest episodes of the original series. I think it was a mistake 20 years later to bring them in as, like, your lead kind of people right out of the gate. I think they needed new blood right off the bat. And I think that's where TNG we saw really flourished.
Yeah, with, like, say, bringing in Iris Stephen Bear, yeah. Michael Piller.
Yes.
We also get, by season three, we have Ron Moore.
Yes.
It goes to say that by the time they switch over uniforms, they've also switched over a lot of those, a lot of the people on the writing staff.
Right.
Not a coincidence, like, it gets a whole lot better.
Yeah. Like, I mean, those writers, you know, who I named, like, are incomparable, like, in their day. But I just, again, I don't think it's really right to kind of haul people out decades later and be like, make the show relevant to nowadays.
But it's tough because, like, how old were those writers at the time? Because,
right.
like, I don't know, like, they must have been, like, well into their 40s, I'd guess.
Yeah.
So it's yeah. a little tougher than, I don't know, maybe he's just used to them on the convention circuit by that right. point.
Right.
Give him another chance. But I don't know, it's a tough order.
Mm-hmm.
When you're going and bringing back a series after 20 years.
Right.
Well, Cam, I want to talk a little bit about Maurice Hurley as yeah. well, because this guy was fascinating to me. And he, and again, like, we're not trying to rip on Gene Roddenberry here.
Right.
But we are. But, like, we're explaining what happened in this documentary. But Maurice Hurley said that he was more obsessed with his legacy than proficiency as a storyteller.
Yeah.
Let's take a look at some of those... storytelling conceits that we'd get in early Next Generation. It'd often just be formed around an idea, like a high concept idea,
right.
as opposed to the characters. And that was a mandate that Michael Piller brought in, was that they had to be character-based as opposed to this, you know, kernel of an idea and let's do something interesting.
Right.
What I'm getting at here is, like, I watched so many of these season one episodes, and by the end of it, I was like, well, I have no idea what that episode was about.
Yeah.
And I'm not just talking about, like, oh, it's confusing storytelling-wise, but, like, I don't know what the theme is.
Right.
What do you think...
Well, we talked about, I mean, even Encounter at Farpoint, which has, like, two different messages going on at kind of at the same time.
Yeah. And well, explain, like... that for listeners who may not have seen the documentary. Well, why did that happen?
Because originally, Gene Roddenberry wanted a one-hour pilot. He was dead set. There would only be a one-hour pilot. And DC Fontana wrote this one-hour pilot, and they said, no, we need 2 hours. So he went and turned her one-hour script called Meeting at Farpoint into a two-parter, and he created Q. And I think right there, Gene Roddenberry had a good idea.
Yeah.
I think the good stuff in Encounter at Farpoint was Gene Roddenberry's.
Not the jellyfish?
Well, second best, I guess.
Okay. Where are the apples?
Third
don't,
best.
don't do that with the apples.
Yeah, but I mean, I just really question a lot of the storytelling because I was watching, as I said, The Neutral Zone today, which is the finale of this season. And I'm watching it going like, why do you have this kind of bizarro, really light, people from the past wake up in the future sort of story with like a wacky country musician who wants to like start a band with Data, intermixed with them going to the neutral zone to encounter Romulans for the first time in like, I don't know, 20, 30 or whatever, 100 years.
I think honestly it's one of those situations where you toss something at a wall and see what sticks.
Yeah.
And they're like, okay, we're 26 episodes in. I guess these are our last two ideas we need to cram into the end of the season.
Yeah, it's bizarre. Like the tonal mishmash that is this episode. And that goes for quite a few episodes throughout the season where we're asked to care about something, like something dramatic, but they're like, make it really cheeseball.
Well, that's okay. And that's my issue that I had when I was doing research for this. And also, we've recently been rewatching other season one, season two episodes of Next Generation for research for other episodes.
Yeah.
So I was surprisingly up to date with a lot of these episodes that I really have not been interested in watching since I saw them as a kid.
Right.
So, I don't know, honestly, one of the first episodes I saw in syndication, because I remember, I think it was when Next Generation was syndicated,
mm-hmm.
I'm talking 5 days a week, that's when I really got into the series, and one of the first ones I ever saw was Code of Honor.
Okay, yeah.
And I think as a 7, 8, or 9-year-old, I think I was 8, like, I was watching that.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is garbage.
Right.
Like, in...
I remember when I watched it, what really jumped out... was actually just how much of a kind of a ripoff of A Mock Time it was by the end.
Yeah.
And you see that, you know, they ripped off, you know, Naked Time also in yes. that season. So it's like, they were really just, I love like in the first like five, within the first five episodes of season one, they're like, let's just rip off original series episodes.
But it's so bizarre because like the whole mandate was like, no, we're not going to have a chief engineer. We don't want to just repeat everything from the original series. We do not want a science officer. We're not going to have a communications officer. So like, oh, okay, so you guys are changing things up. But yeah, we're just going to literally like plagiarize like previous story ideas from the original series. Like
right.
It was just very bizarre to me. But what I'm getting at here is like watching Code of Honor, the whole time I'm just like, I don't care what happens. I'm utterly, utterly ambivalent. Same with episodes like Justice.
I wanted to say about Justice.
Okay.
Like Justice is one where I think the camp value is actually... really entertaining.
Oh, believe me, I was laughing my ass off.
Yeah, like the first half of that episode is really at least entertaining and amusing. Kind of like Shore Leave or something like that, where you're just like, this is ridiculous. The second half is so boring that
I didn't even understand what was going on.
No, it's like them fighting over this flower pot and giving like big grand speeches, and I'm like, I'm just like mind-numbed watching this.
I think, yeah, the Edo woman ended up looking at the god through a window.
Yeah.
And I was just like, okay, I don't... So when I watch...
It was like the Guardian of the Planet or something?
Yeah. But here, okay. When I watch movies or TV, I give my full attention. Like, if right. my phone goes off, I turn my alerts off and stuff. I do get kind of perturbed if I'm watching with somebody and they're on their phone.
Right.
Cam, when I'm doing research for seasons 1, 2 of Next Generation, yeah. I was on my phone a whole lot.
Right.
I was folding laundry a whole lot. And look, this is more of an indictment on those storytellers more than anything else. I don't think those episodes deserve my full attention. Did you have that feeling?
Yeah, I do. And it's a misunderstanding of the tone, like, because the original series definitely embraced camp, but it did it in a way that was fun and compelling.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it was light, it was colorful, it was goofy, but it also grabbed you with great ideas, great characters. So you look at, like, season one of TNG, and you have a lot of episodes that are kind of going for the camp. You've got, like, Symbiosis, which is, like, the drug episode. You've got, you know, Justice.
Drugs make you feel good.
You've got Code of Honor.
What's that?
You've got...
Racism?
Yeah, I guess.
Addressing racism?
Selling racism? I don't
yeah.
know. You've got the Binar episode. You've got tons of episodes...
Yeah, that sells jazz.
You've got a lot of episodes... that are very campy,
yeah.
right? And yet, unlike the original series, they're no fun.
No, not at all.
And that's, like, they really get bogged down in characters giving kind of really self-important speeches and not, like, glorious Kirk-like sexy speeches.
Well, it's so stiff. Like, yeah. The characters are very stiff, and it takes itself so seriously.
And there's no real colors to the show either.
Well, the thing that I enjoyed going through the Blu-rays is watching how the colors can pop after they've been remastered and everything like that. But it's really just a very 80s kind of beige sort of look versus, boy, like we were just talking recently about how amazing Inamir Darkly looks when they board the original USS Defiant from the 23rd century.
Right.
They're all in these old school uniforms and just the corridors. And you're like, oh my gosh. Like, TNG never looked close to that, even after it's been remastered. How would audiences have responded to a return to camp, Cam?
I mean, it's tough to say. Like, I mean, the 80s, it was a period where it was, like, kind of this, like, what, at the time, I think they felt was realistic was actually really superficially silly and, like,
well, like, flashy. Putting men in skirts as well as women in skirts?
Yeah, I don't know. No, I don't think that was a big trend, but...
No, but I'm talking about on Next Generation.
Right. Yeah. I don't know, like, because I feel like the original Star Trek was so perfectly tied to the 60s aesthetic.
Yeah.
Do you think the first couple seasons of TNG was really emblematic of the 80s style?
No, I could make an argument for that, because I watched those early seasons, and I'm just like, ooh, that feels like the 80s. And
I've been going, a bad way.
Yes, but I've been going through, like, later... I'm up to, like, season 5 of Next Generation.
Right.
And I'm not like, oh, that's so 90s at all. It seems a little bit more ageless. But those first couple seasons, maybe even midway or maybe all the way through season 3 also feels very 80s.
Right.
Even though I guess it's 1990 at that point. Right. Anyway.
Is it just that 60s aesthetic has held up way better over time than 80s?
Oh, good gosh, yes. Like,
will there be a period where the 80s will come back around and we'll be like, boy, the 80s look great?
Well, do you know what one of our former guests pointed out to me, one Julia Dilworth, we remarked on what kids are wearing nowadays.
Right.
And apparently, and I only noticed it when she pointed it out, but now I see it everywhere, people are wearing, like, washed out jeans and, like, wearing, like, high-waisted pants. The 90s are back.
Right.
Cam, the 90s was not a great decade for fashion.
Flannel?
Yeah, okay. That looks very dated, though. You know, like, if everybody was walking around. It would be amazing if the next Star Trek series, everybody walks around like Kurt Cobain, like, just dressed like that in their office.
I want to go back to, like, 90s era Nine Inch Nails with, like, the fishnet sleeves.
Yeah.
That'd be pretty bad.
What are you talking about? You already are.
The
cod piece
latex.
You want to go with 1990s Marilyn Manson with the one breast implant?
No, he had both.
Oh, did he?
He did have both.
I thought it was just one.
Nope, he had both.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, there you go.
Yep. So, it was the one eye. He had the one white eye.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I was more into Nirvana. You were more into Marilyn Manson during that period. Yeah. So,
I was very emo.
Back to motifs. The 60s holds up.
Yeah.
Why do you think, like, Mad Men is, like, praised for just the look of the series? The cinematography, the costume design, just so many awards that it got. It's because the 80s looked terrific. I mean, when we're talking about both cinema.
You mean the 60s looked terrific?
I'm sorry. Yeah, the 60s looked terrific, both in terms of cinema, like, just the way people dress. Like, even haircuts there. Like, okay, you might have a beehive or something like that, but, like... Right. The Don Draper, like, slick back hair ages far better than, let's say, Deanna Troi's perm.
Right.
So that 80s aesthetic, it feels like an 80s show, but not a great 80s show. Like, you can go watch Hill Street Blues, Miami Vice, Equalizer. Like, okay, that takes place in the 80s, but you can appreciate what they're doing there.
Right.
You know, this,
There's also just the issue that in the 60s, they were shooting on celluloid. And then when they got to the 80s, they shot on much cheaper film stock in that decade. So that's why a lot of 80s movies look really washed out now, and why TV also does not look very good.
Cam, you and I, we just got back from a screening of Purple Rain over this past weekend, starring
Let's go
one
crazy.
Prince.
Yeah.
It made doves cry.
That's right.
But, you know, that movie, I enjoyed that. But it's got the camp factor, for sure.
What are you talking about?
But here's the thing, and it looks very 80s, but I think it's aged in a way that...
It's charming.
That's charming.
Yeah, other than the rampant, hateful misogyny.
Other than that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, it's got a certain charm to its own 80s aesthetic. And, of course, it took place in 1984.
Yeah.
That maybe Next Generation lacks, just coming in 1987.
Well, it's also very stylized. The first couple seasons of TNG have, like, zero style.
Well, it's just bland, mundane, like I said before, beige on beige. Like, even, okay, the biggest style that you would take note of is the bridge has, like, fake wood paneling that they eventually get rid of.
Yeah.
It's like, thank you, because that's so 80s. But just think about, like, all the other creative choices where, like, yes, we need to have a therapist on the bridge.
Right.
So you're having issues, like, we brought it up earlier, like, do they even know what to do with these characters? And that's the thing. Would you describe this as a character-based drama in seasons one or two?
No, not really. I mean, no, it's not like the characters feel like they're being developed. It's more like the characters are tools to help solve the mystery of the day.
You feel as if you could kind of switch a lot of these characters in and out of whatever situation.
Yeah.
And it could be instead of a Riker-centric episode, it could be a Geordi-centric episode.
I think it's interesting in, like, the first couple seasons how often Picard seems to not know what's going on his ship.
Yeah.
And he's like, what's going on this ship? It's like he's really played like the clueless dad.
It's true, though.
Like, you look at Picard, like, season most of three and onwards, for sure four onwards.
Yeah.
Picard knows what's going on his ship.
Do you think that's part of Michael Piller wanting the captain to not look like such a fuddy-duddy? Or do you think Patrick Stewart's like, guys, please?
Well, I mean, in the Chaos on the Bridge, Shatner talks about how... I don't know if it was Shatner, but in the documentary they say that, like, Roddenberry really saw himself as, like, Kirk, who was, like, the ladies' man. But then he saw himself as Picard, who was, like, kind of the wise older man. Maybe he was also kind of the clueless guy who didn't know what was going on.
Yeah. Speaking of which, I mean... Okay, so we can touch upon this very briefly, because we already did a full episode on the Wesley factor. Yeah. But watching Code of Honor... that's very early on in season one, and you literally have a scene in which, like, Wesley's standing in a turbo lift, and Riker's like, I'll get rid of him.
Right.
And Wesley's like, no, I'm in the turbo lift. I was only told I can't be on the bridge.
Yeah.
And, like, you've got helicopter mom Beverly Crusher begging the captain to bring her kid onto the bridge.
Yeah.
It's just like... It's so awkward because, okay, what I'm getting at, though, is those are the character moments here.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Data growing a beard. Yeah. And I'm just like, these are not great character moments that really tell you or really get at what the core of this character is.
I think there's moments with Data. Data's the one they're interested in because you do get episodes like Data Lore, which do kind of... They tell us something about Data, which... I mean,
Wesley knows the real Data.
But it tells us more about the character of Data than pretty much any character. Most of the characters don't get a lot of development in that season. Data's the only one they show even a glimmer of real interest in.
Yeah, during that first season, I can give you that.
Except for Wesley. They have a lot of interest in Wesley.
But I would say, and I just think they're obligated to focus on Picard a lot. So, you know, I was watching clips of him... you know, play or, you know, compete in fencing.
Right.
And I was just like, okay, this is not compelling at all.
Well, you also have, like, the big goodbye. You know, you get, like, stuff like really, you know, Picard on the holodeck episode. Like...
Okay, so they're trying, but they're failing. Like, that's what's happening with the writers. They're trying to see what they can do with these characters, and they just don't have any sort of strong grasp, and I think they're hampered really by... The storytelling deficiencies that persist in this.
Right.
What do you think of this idea? What if they just tried to emulate TOS as much as possible, threw it in the 24th century, but tried to emulate TOS? Do you think it would be more successful than what we got in seasons one and two of Next Gen? Because here's what I'm getting at, though. Mm-hmm. I think it was genius of them, in hindsight now, to do everything they could not to copy the original series.
Right.
You know, and I thought it was genius on the part of the Deep Space Nine guys to not try to be just a copy of Next Generation.
Right, yeah, yeah.
But what about that proposal that I threw at you about them trying their best to emulate what was great about TOS and then putting it in the 24th century with the same, say, crew?
I think had they, in season one and two, embraced more of the original series sort of high-spirited adventure and genre hopping, I think we might look back on season one and two with more fun. I think they would be more watchable now and okay. maybe more fun. Now, on the flip side of that, you don't get the evolution that leads you into season three and onwards. Like, you don't get to
yeah.
all good things, probably, you know, and, you know, all the great chain of command, what have you, if you are, you know, just doing kind of adventure stories.
But, boy, that's a long wait.
It is a long wait.
It's
but
50 episodes of season one and season two that yeah. you have to get through.
Yeah.
But and the characters are just so stiff.
Right. And then let's kind of like segue into season two a little bit and talk a little bit about it. Like, because season two gets in some ways even more chaotic, where you, you know, have Beverly Crusher getting kicked out the door.
Yeah. But we do get Pulaski.
Yeah.
Isn't that a bonus?
I think Pulaski, I'm not a huge fan of Pulaski, but I appreciate that they gave her a very definable personality right out of the gate.
Yeah, really definably boring
one. No, I don't think she's boring. She has personality.
Okay, she has a personality, but is it compelling?
Is it compelling? It's,
she's like, I don't like transporters, just like the last doctor on...
Well, they're going for a Bones.
Yeah.
Female Bones, yeah. I mean, at least I appreciate that she's feels fairly well-defined as to what kind of character she is.
Okay.
Like, look at Crusher in season one.
She's a helicopter mom.
Yeah.
Beyond that, I couldn't tell you much about her character.
Like,
same with Troy.
Tashi Yar, you know, a lot of these characters. Tashi Yar has, like, moments of strength, but then when you get to mid-season, she's kind of just this kind of blank character that shows up.
Yeah, she just does exposition.
And, yeah. You know. A lot of these characters. Geordi is very vague, season one. I can appreciate that when Pulaski shows up, they know what kind of character they want her to be.
Yeah. Well, where do you think she... Do you think she would have been the same character season two if she had made it all the way to season seven? Like, do you think she would have had a character arc same as some of the other characters grew and developed, I should say?
I think so. I think the arc would have been about her kind of growing closer to Data over
yeah.
the series.
Do you think she would have lightened up a little?
Yeah,
less grumpy?
I don't think she ever was a very good fit for the series.
Diane Mulder even admitted that in the documentary
yeah.
here, which is kind of uncomfortable.
I think the TNG crew works best as sort of Picard is the patriarch and everyone else is kind of younger. Whereas when you throw in a Pulaski, she's, you know, an older woman, it kind of throws that balance off.
Well, if done well, it could have worked.
Could have.
You know, where, maybe. Like, he has somebody who's more of an equal, you yeah. know, closer in rank. Because, like, Riker's still pretty green at
right.
this point.
But it is the Next Generation.
Yeah, that's true. It could have been more of like a mother-father situation with the
right.
crew there. I don't know. Like, I
Do
honestly...
people want to see that? Are you arguing for the show?
No.
Should this be the next Star Trek 2017?
Believe me, no, I'm not. I'm just trying to get in the mindset of like what these writers were trying to do in those early seasons, because it's
yeah.
not something that I particularly care for. I honestly have like a visceral reaction when I see those early uniforms, where I'm just like, ooh, that's not an episode I want to watch.
Right.
You know, like, yeah, you give me Riker without a beard, you throw Patrick Stewart in the skin-tight spandex, and I'm just like, this is not the Next Generation that I ever really fell in love with.
Right. So my question to you is, when we get to season two, do you think season two evolves at all from season one, or
yeah.
do you think it's more of the same? Like,
no,
what do you think changes?
I think it evolves.
You're like Riker, bad at Pulaski.
Riker, yeah. Riker grows a beard.
Yeah.
But here's no, I think they came back and they realized, look, we need to figure out what these guys are about.
Yeah.
So they gave, you know, Geordi something to do. We're coming into the season. Worf is now officially, you know, chief tactical officer.
Right.
We've got, like you said, Crusher, Dr. Crusher, gets the boots.
Yeah.
And Wesley decides to stick around. And is this the season that he's officially acting ensign with that?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah. So they are giving more well-defined jobs to a lot of people they didn't have a great handle on.
He's going, except, like, for Starfleet Academy testing and all that sort of stuff. And then,
Troy, I don't know. Question. Like, don't we start off with the child quite early on in the season?
That's the premiere.
Dear Lord.
I mean, this is the season two where they're like, Data's our breakout character. We got to focus on Data. Because you get Elementary Dear Data, which is, you know, the fan beloved. I'm not a big fan of it, but it's the, you know, the Sherlock Holmes episode. You get Schizoid Man with his, like, grandfather coming around. You get Pen Pals. Data is definitely kind of getting a lot of attention this season.
Well, what I found, though, is... So,
oh, and of course, Measure of a Man.
Yeah, yeah. That's probably the best... would you say that's the best episode of first two seasons?
Yes, I would.
Yeah.
It was interesting, though. I rewatched it actually today. It's an episode that is, I think, by far the best. It has great writing. It has great stuff with Picard and Data both. But when I'm watching the episode, I'm like, I have a hard time believing this scenario is happening in the 24th century.
Yeah, I know.
Like, the whole thing is, like, Data is going to be, like, strip-mined for, like, experimentation. The thing is, like, we've seen androids in the original series. Like Kirk fell in love with one in Requiem for Methuselah. Like, I don't feel like by the 24th century they're like, you're not a being.
I can give it a pass because it's such a good episode. Yeah, but it is... I can turn a blind eye to this little conceit that they're going to drop here.
Right.
But I agree. Look, even like the best has its flaws.
Sure.
But okay, so do you see evolution going on in season two?
I see an understanding of who their popular characters are. Like, they're kind of taking the notes going, okay, people like Data. People want to see, you know, kind of more Picard stories. We get to see some stuff like with Oksana Troi kind of pursuing Picard. Like, the idea of, like, Picard as sort of the curmudgeon who can be comedy relief becomes kind of a little more prevalent in season two. Like, you can see they're figuring out kind of some of the ideas that work.
Well, they also, I think by this time they had realized that, I think, look, if the top three from TOS were Spock, Bones, and Kirk, I think they... by season two, they had realized that the top three were going to be Picard, Riker, and Data.
Yeah.
And, I don't know, we get great episodes like when Riker's dad comes and meets the crew and he puts the moves on Pulaski, I suppose.
Right.
But
That would be Icarus Factor.
I love how you have that memorized.
Yes, I know.
Well, that's your back tattoo, your lower back tattoo.
Tramp stamp.
Yeah. So yeah, we do see that evolution with, they have a better, stronger grasp of the characters. What would you rather have on a desert island? Only season one or only season two, Cam?
I think I'd take season two.
Yeah.
There's more episodes that I like. It still has, though, that same continuing problem with camp that is really boring.
Yeah.
You have one of my least favorite episodes of all time that season, which is the Royale.
Where they just wander through revolving doors all episode.
Yeah, no, that's where Silence has Lisa.
But Royale has that.
Yes,
they have an obsession with doors.
That go nowhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a symbol for the entire season. you have, like, the Dauphin. You know, you have Up the Long Ladder.
Don't you like your Irish stereotypes, Cameron?
Well, I do.
I know you do.
I do. But you have an awful lot of stuff like that.
Yes, an awful.
Awful. But, you know, you can see by the end of season two, like, and this is another reason I would say I'd take this one. You have, like, Q-Who, which is obviously where the Borg show up. And it's like, they're finally, you can see they're figuring out ideas.
Although, it was interesting to note that Maurice Hurley did not know what season that one aired in. Like, I could tell when he was doing the documentary. And surprisingly enough, William Shatner did not correct him.
No.
I was surprised.
Which is kind of astonishing because William Shatner did, of course, write a novel about the Borg.
Yeah, that's how Kirk was brought back.
Yeah.
A conspiracy between the Borg and the Romulans, I believe.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously Shatner knows all there is to know about Star Trek mythology.
So. Well, obviously, like, I bet he studied, like, all the Borg episodes intently before he wrote that novel.
I would imagine so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, well, okay.
Do you feel like, generally among fans, though, season two is held higher or lower than season one? I feel like lower.
Really?
Because of the Pulaski factor.
And you're not having all the familiar crew members around.
Yeah.
I think people, there's, I know this sounds so artificial, and or I should say superficial, but honestly, I think people recognize, oh, Riker's got the beard now. We're getting closer to the era that is better.
Right, and, that we recognize.
Yeah, so I would, I don't know, maybe we can pull people in Las Vegas when you go to the convention, and we'll also be presenting in front of an audience for all you people that would like to see Subspace Transmissions live on stage.
Right.
But we can take a poll and ask people what they prefer, seasons one or two.
Right.
If you pushed me, like, I just can't think of really many what's the biggest standout episode of season one? Conspiracy?
Yeah, and I think I like Conspiracy. I'm a fan. Yeah, that's...
There's a lot more season two standout episodes, even though we do have stuff like Shades of Grey, which are just...
Maybe Data Lore.
Garbage. Data Lore might be... season one?
Yeah, season one. That might be the standout.
Yeah, I genuinely like that episode, not just because... It's only good for season one.
I think people have a certain fondness. I don't know if they would say it's a great episode or even a good episode, but Naked Now, I think, has its fans.
It's fan.
So I want to talk, I think, about... We've kind of spent, you know, a period of time now saying that season one and two don't work at all. What does work about them? Like, what, out of all of this chaos, were they getting right for these first two seasons that would be carried into the TNG we know and love?
Well, look, if you want to praise anything, I think you have to praise the actors at this point, because I think the actors, they're still struggling with who these characters are supposed to be, but so many of them have such charisma and charm to them that I think that I'm still interested in seeing what they can do.
Yeah.
Storytelling-wise... That's where you got me, because this is what I keep going back to. By the end of all these episodes, I don't know what they're about thematically.
Right.
I look, if you want to make a cool, high-concept sci-fi episode, go for it. But if you don't make anything that's cohesive in a thematic sense, you're not giving me any reason to invest in what's going on.
Right.
I don't know. But Cam, tell me what works for you during season one and two.
I think the key is kind of similar to what you're saying, the casting and the characters.
Yeah.
I think what they figure out is a lot of the character dynamics that work. I think the Picard and Riker stuff is very compelling. I think the Q-Picard relationship is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
The Loxana-Troy-Picard stuff is a lot of fun. Like, they figure out... Picard Wesley, like, they figure out these individuals. It's a lot of to do with Picard, quite frankly, but also Data and Geordi.
But you know,
comes out in season two really prominently.
You bring up Picard a lot, and I think that's all credit to Patrick Stewart, who nobody really wanted to hire at first.
Right.
I think John Pike had his back.
Yeah.
Or wait, no, did. I think John Pike was like, no, you can't hire a bald dude. What are you talking about? And Gene Roddenberry's like, yeah, I don't care. And I think Gene Roddenberry didn't want him until there's actually they met in person and they had like a line reading there. But all props to Patrick Stewart. I mean, it's hard not to find that guy, you know, really compelling, which is what they had a huge deficit of, is like any real compelling characters.
And he's compelling despite the fact he's not really the Picard we get to know that well later on.
Well, he doesn't see... Okay, because you brought up, you know, the wise old man, but does he seem really wise, or does he just seem a bit of a fuddy-duddy?
Fuddy-duddy who's, like, constantly seems ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like, he's getting, like, snowballs thrown at him in the hallway. Like, he just seems like he's there to kind of be, like, brought down for comedy's sake.
Yes. And so, I'm just left with...
Like, the dignity isn't there.
But you can imagine why... fans were watching these first two seasons and they're like, what the hell is this supposed to be? This is not Star Trek. This is a disgrace. Yeah. And they even said so, like, I think Ron Moore may have said in the documentary, but he said, like, nobody really considered us to be real Trek until after Best of Both Worlds premiered. Then I do wonder if people went and retroactively came to appreciate season three, because I do see a huge leap in quality in season three.
Yeah.
Because Cam, for you, you didn't actually realize that leap at the time, did you?
No, I was so burnt out after season one and two that I made it, I'm going to say, maybe a quarter through season three. And I was like, I got to take a break. And that's when I burnt through all four seasons of Enterprise.
Right.
And then came back to TNG because I was just like, I can't keep doing this to myself.
Yeah. I wonder what it was specifically, because I really do see that they start putting an emphasis more on characters than story beginning with that season. So I just honestly, I think
characters other than Wesley.
That's true. But no, I think it just came down to a case of you just being utterly burnt out on the series. Not that you didn't appreciate what you're getting, or not that you weren't capable of appreciating what they were doing.
No, it was just, I think I was just burnt out on two seasons of bad TV.
Well, that's kind of what happened with me with Enterprise. It's like, I was burnt out on that show after two seasons, and people kept saying, oh no, man, like, it's getting good, it's really good. Right. And to me, I just like, I don't care.
And let's remember, too, like, I closed off season two with, you know, Shades of Grey, one of the most infamous and notorious Star Trek episodes of all time. And it was like, oh my god, like, what am I... Seriously, like, we've got, this is the low point of the entire Star Trek experience up until These Are the Voyages. you know, it's like, what am I looking forward to? Because, like, I've seen Best of Both Worlds at that, you know, long before that, but I'm like, I can't keep sitting through shit like this just to rewatch that episode.
Yeah.
And I don't blame you. And people kept, you know, obviously would say, oh, it gets better, but I was like, I need a break.
Well, you eventually came around to season three of Next Gen. I eventually came around to season three of Enterprise.
I feel like four for Next Gen is really where it's just like, it's flying. Four and five and six, I thought, were just like flying like perfectly. There's bad episodes or whatever in between, but the quality level is very high.
Okay, just as we wrap up here, like, what would the legacy of Next Generation been had it been canceled after one or two seasons?
I think it would have just been the mistake.
Do you think people would have seen any potential within there, or do you think it would have just been utterly dismissed? Would it have had its, you know, ardent supporters? At least like a small
There's
contingent.
Always going to be a cult audience that will support even the most useless of crap.
Yeah.
If it falls under, you know, a genre. I'm sure it would have had its fans who said, you know, who knows what it could have been had it kept going. Do you think, had season three not happened, when do you think, say season three turned out exactly like season two.
Yeah.
When do you think the show would have gone off the air? They never fixed it. Like, it continued as it was.
I think it would have lasted because, honestly, the ratings were high enough during those first two seasons that they could justify, you know, renewing it for season three.
Yeah.
I don't know what Star Trek would have turned into from there. I really don't see us getting a Deep Space Nine.
No.
I really don't see this crew taking over the franchise for four films.
Right.
So I envision a very different reality when it comes to Star Trek. Mm-hmm. So one that's, I think, I don't know, it would have gone off the air in 94 and they would have tried returning to it, I don't know, a decade later or something. I don't know what network, because it made business sense for Voyager to launch on UPN.
Right.
Maybe they would have still tried to do its spinoff, if only because of the advent of UPN.
Right.
Who knows? So, I don't. What are your thoughts about that question?
I feel like it would have limped along for a while.
Yeah.
And it would have gone off the air very, like, inauspiciously. It would have just kind of quietly just disappeared into the nether.
But
And fans might be like, oh, we missed Star Trek, but that would have been about the end of it.
Well, maybe I'm rethinking my response to you now, because do you think fans would have stuck around if, you know, we get to seasons 3, 4, 5, and it's still the same quality as seasons 1 and 2.
I do think a lot of them would have.
Yeah.
And it would have been because, you know, hey, they like Data. They like certain characters. Like,
enough to justify,
you know what?
Here's budget.
The thing. As, like, a fan of things that weren't always popular or particularly good, fans will stick around if they love a property.
Yeah.
Just looking for the good. Like, as a comic book fan, I watched every comic book movie through the 80s and 90s. I was watching straight to video, you know, the Captain America movie from, like, 1990 with, like, Matt Salinger being like, well, Red Skull looked cool in the first 5 minutes. Like, I was just looking for whatever I could find. And I feel like Trek fans would kind of fall under the same umbrella. I think I would have been like that.
I used to be like that.
Yeah.
I don't have time anymore. Like, I don't have time for, like, series that take a long time to get into.
But you're also looking at it from the vantage point of someone now who's bombarded by countless television series. Take yourself back to where there's not that many TV series.
Also, countless great TV series. Yeah. Like, there's a lot of really awesome shows to watch on TV. I don't have time to watch, like, kind of mediocre ones.
But take yourself back to, you know, childhood when you started watching TNG.
Yeah.
You probably would have kept watching it.
Well, that...
I was watching Baywatch and stuff like that, or, like, Time Tracks and shows like that. They weren't great TV.
I've mentioned it on the podcast before, but my first memory of The Next Generation was... like, I swear to God, this is true. Like, I was, like, 3 years old, I think, and the one featuring the Bynars, 1001, the one. And I looked at it. I was utterly captivated by what I was seeing. And this is Data. I remember seeing Data. I remember seeing the Bynars, and I remember seeing the big space station.
Mm-hmm.
So even as, like, a toddler, like, I was captivated by what I was seeing. So I guess, you know, I'm not trying to offend any of the fans that were adults watching this and were captivated by season one.
You were captivated by Riker hitting on a holodeck woman?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, honestly, yeah, if you skip ahead in 5 years and TNG is now syndicated 5 days a week, I'm sure I would have been watching it even if it was crappy.
Yeah.
So, honestly, there are a whole lot of crappy episodes I watched as a kid that I liked and going back and watch now for research for the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just like, dear Lord, I like that episode.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But some that I did not like at the time.
Right.
Such as Sub Rosa.
Oh, God.
Which I just rewatched the last few months. Camp. That is camp. That is something you and I are going to have to rewatch and just comment on.
Wait, I have to?
Yes, because honestly, that is so entertaining. It's all unintentional comedy.
Right, yeah.
I think that's one of the funniest episodes of Star Trek, period.
Okay. So. I mean, yeah, I look forward to that. I don't really, but I'm being polite. Now, I'm curious, do you think that season one and two tarnished Gene Roddenberry's kind of legacy at all?
No, because there's so many apologists out there for him still. Yeah. And I think those apologists really need to take a critical look at things. You and I think we get a bit of blowback from a lot of the hardcore Star Trek community that think that maybe we're too critical of the series. I don't think there's anything wrong with being critical about a franchise that you're passionate about. Yeah. And I get so much more out of Star Trek by casting a critical eye on, like, hey, what are the successes? What are the failures?
Right.
So
we've had, like, honestly, like, really, really great, fun discussions on bad episodes.
Yeah.
Where it's not just like, it was bad. Like, we're really breaking apart. Like, why didn't this episode work?
Yeah, and that's what I find, like, look, it's not like as if Star Trek fans are going to claim that every single episode is gold. A lot of them say, oh, this is the worst episode of all time.
Threshold.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, you know, we went back and rewatched.
I think Threshold is interesting.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
It wasn't nearly as bad as I remembered it being upon this rewatch. I think it just gained so much infamy over the decades.
It's wildly unsuccessful. Yes. But it's not coming from a place of, like, just boredom of just, like, cranking out an episode.
Yeah.
It's not like a lot of the season one episodes of TNG.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Gene Roddenberry's legacy, it's still intact.
Mm-hmm.
Look, it's intact at this point. I just want people to be realistic when, you know, they're seeing CBS revive Star Trek, putting on CBS All Access, and they're like, it's not real Star Trek. It's not what Gene Roddenberry would have wanted. I'm like, Gene Roddenberry wanted men and women wearing skirts on a 24th century starship. He wanted, like, a whole lot of wacky doodle things, as Maurice Hurley called them. It really didn't work that well.
And even actually prior to TNG, he wanted Star Trek the Motion Picture, which fans don't generally hold in very high regard.
No. So if you're looking at his post TOS output, not a lot of fans dig his work, and I don't think people are willing to admit that so much, though.
And I think we just have to, like, respect the fact that Gene Roddenberry's, like any human, his sensibilities changed over time.
Yeah.
And where he saw the franchise going, I don't think was where fans really want to see the series go.
I was having a discussion a few months ago with our classmate slash fallen comrade Ben Yang.
Right.
And he was asking if I had ever thought about getting a tattoo.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, absolutely.
And you were like, yeah, I have the Binar.
No, I have the Icarus factor too.
Of course.
But what I said is like, no. And the reason why is because whatever I would have gotten 10 years ago,
yeah,
I would have hated it now. And so whatever I would get
is
now.
Why you have that tattoo of a pog?
Yeah, my elf pog.
Yeah.
And whatever I would get now, I'd probably hate in 10 years. Your right. sensibilities change dramatically over the years. That's why, you know, they kind of say like bands really hit their peak, you know, before anybody turns 30.
Yeah.
After that, it's all just kind of downhill,
right.
you know. So, but would a band have made the same record at age 40 as they would have at age 23? I'm sure right. there's stuff they're like, oh man, I can't believe I struck that chord.
But had you gotten a tattoo, say at 18, of the Enterprise, would you regret it?
Depends on where it was on my body and what it looked like.
Obviously on the neck.
No, on the face.
It's like a Mike Tyson tattoo.
Yeah.
Like the saucer section's like over your eyes.
And it can separate when I have to like furrow my brows to connect it. And then like when I unfurl my brows, then it separates.
Obviously, yes.
Yeah. Would I have regretted that, Cam? Not one iota.
So before we sign off, I want to just talk a little bit about the actual Chaos on the Bridge documentary. Is this the definitive account of season 1 to TNG? Like, do you think Shatner has made a really good documentary on the subject? Like, is this a must-see for fans?
I think it's a perfectly competent documentary, perfectly acceptable. Look, there's enough fun stuff, enough great interviews in there.
Yeah. Iris Stephen Bear alone is always entertaining.
Oh, yeah. Here's the thing. I wasn't, like, I found The Captains to be an interesting documentary. I don't know if I say it was particularly well made,
mm-hmm.
you know, from an aesthetic point of view.
Yeah. There's some really clunky stuff in that. We're like, Shatner's like sitting in a box or something.
Yeah.
You're like, what is the point of this?
Yes.
I love when he like latches onto these bizarre like little motifs and you're like, what is he doing?
Well, for instance, the motif going on in Chaos on the Bridge is Western themed.
They're playing poker.
Yeah, they're playing poker a lot of the time.
You can see the interview where that like jumped into his head.
Yeah, but yeah. There's like banjos, you know, and like it's like, okay. Here's the thing. Yeah, I think fans should watch this? Absolutely. Will they find it interesting? Absolutely. There's a lot of fun stuff. So yeah, is this the definitive season 1-2 documentary? Camp, it's the only 1-2 documentary aside from maybe some of those like special features from the Blu-rays, but
one of my favorite bits of it is actually just Jonathan Frakes talking to Shatner, because you can tell they know each other really well, and they're just like cracking up, both of them, just like it's frankly a terrible interview, but it's like just the two of them just like totally like killing each other.
Well, it's just like these guys know each other from like the convention circuit so well, like why not just like mucker? What would happen if like Benjamin Yang tried to record a very serious documentary with you? You would just be messing with him the whole time.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
So, what are your thoughts? Is this the definitive season 1-2 documentary?
I mean, it's
slash
the only.
Only.
It feels like it's such a subject for like that could be really rife for like a really really great book. Like I know they put out those books for each season of the original series. I would like to see them do those for TNG because I think the first couple seasons would be fascinating to read about. Like, I feel like just watching this, and it's only an hour-long documentary.
Yeah.
I feel like there's so much more story to tell. And you can tell, like, a lot of times the chronology of the events they're talking about seem really weird.
That's because these are, like, older people trying to recount what happened when. Like, so there's a lot of mix-ups, I can tell, just watching it, but
like, Iris Stephen Bear is talking about, like, Captain's Holiday, but that felt, like, quite a while later than they're really talking about.
Well, I think they were talking about how they're trying to figure out what works best, and Patrick Stewart is like, you need more shooting and more effing for the captain. And I guess that was their example as captain. I guess there's a long interlude talking about Ryza. Like, Patrick Stewart is like, it's the only planet I remember.
Yeah.
So.
Well, it was interesting because when we saw Patrick Stewart in Vegas a couple summers ago or whatever, last summer, was it last summer? Yep. Yeah, last summer. he seemed to not remember a lot of things.
No,
he and did you get not. That from the documentary too.
Yeah,
like he's not remembering meetings that other people are talking about and things like that.
I mean, he's pushing 80.
Yeah,
I can understand it.
Hey, we'll probably all be there at some point, but I just found that sort of interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Send your thoughts and feedback to subspacetransmissionspod@gmail.com.
Well, coming up next week, guys, definitely tune in. I think we're going to drop the podcast a little earlier than usual because rumor has it, we're going to be seeing the newest trailer for Star Trek Beyond. So tune in. We'll be reviewing it and we'll give our thoughts on it. And I think it's good timing because we just had the current state of Star Trek and we're expressing our concerns about the lack of buzz over this movie.
Right.
Let's see if maybe it generates some buzz based on this upcoming trailer, Cam.
It's been interesting because I've seen a lot of fans posting on like the Facebook groups that there's a lot of talk that the movie's going to be pushed back. Which Paramount did before. They did that with, remember, G.I. Joe 2?
Yeah.
Where, like, they had all the trailers out. They'd been putting, like, and then they just announced, like, a month before release that they were pushing it back, like, 6 months.
But wasn't that because they wanted, like, to film more scenes with Channing Tatum, who had just broken out into a big star all of a sudden?
No, their excuse was they wanted to convert it to 3D.
Oh, right. Okay.
Which was bullshit.
Yeah. I don't think this is going to get pushed back.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I haven't heard anything concrete indicating that.
Well, wait,
but there is a lot of talk about it.
But is this just fan speculation?
I think it got pushed back in Brazil. So now they're theorizing it's going to happen elsewhere. I don't think so.
No.
But then there was no warning for the G.I. Joe one either.
Yeah.
And same studio. So, I mean, I don't think so. I don't think it's going to get pushed back because I think Paramount needs a summer movie this summer. For their bottom line, but I mean, honestly, if you told me they were pushing it, I wouldn't be like surprised. I'd be like, well, there's no trailers or buzz for this movie.
Yeah. Well, we can dig into that even deeper next episode
as
well.
We might have a special guest. Emphasis on might.
Yeah. Emphasis on might. But yeah, also give us a review on iTunes and give us 5 stars. We also read our reviews out loud on the show. I hope that's enough to satisfy your deep desires to be featured on Subspace Transmissions.
I also read them out loud before I go to bed every night.
Yeah.
They make me feel happy.
Well, no, you make me call you and then read them to you.
As I fall asleep.
As you fall asleep, yeah. So, Cam, where can we find you on Twitter?
I'm at Cam V as in Visionary Past is Prime Smith.
Well, Cam, that's pretty dark.
I'm referring to myself.
Yeah. Oh, okay, of course. Well, you can find me at Reportin. That's Reportonn as in naked now.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.